Hi, the name's New Bronner, Dion New Bronner. You're listening to my podcast, Life, Purpose, Leadership, where I chew the fat with guests from many walks of life. Yep, I ponder the big questions, and we play around with some less significant ones too. I sometimes unpick the practice of leadership, delving into what it means to many. We laugh and we explore what it is to live with purpose and meaning. I hope you find the chat as useful as I have having it. Life, purpose, leadership. My guest today is Vandy Massey, a company director and investor, but all-round artist. Yep, she creates stunning visual artwork using watercolors. She started painting in 2009, and 2016 took on the role of chair of the Society of East Anglia Watercolorists. Vandy grew up in South Africa and now lives in Cambridgeshire. Africa still influences her paintings in a discernible way, and she loves strong colours and aims to capture a sense of space and light in her work. Vandy and I chat about art, life, toilet paper, the pandemic, and I guess some really significant elements of how we discern the real truth about art and the real truth about life. Her paintings have been described in the Cambridgeshire Journal as being filled with joy, energy, and colour. And I suggest that today we did the same. I made chocolate cake on the weekend. I like baking.
Yeah.
But I usually use, there is a recipe that Nigella does that has oil, like corn oil, vegetable oil, right? It's the way forward.
If
no one has realized that you don't need butter, I love butter cream when I'm baking. You've missed the boat if you've not realized that, because the moisture in this cake and the flavor in this cake is utterly incredible. I've just had a piece of it, hence my reason not to go and get a cup of tea, because
you'll get another piece of cake.
Well, something like that.
Yeah. I've got a recipe which uses it's an olive oil and orange cake, and it is phenomenal. But you probably have to keep it in the fridge unless you eat it pretty quickly, because it is so moist and has so much sugar in it that actually it doesn't last very, very long before
things start growing on it.
Exactly. But basically, you cook the orange, whole orange, pull out the pips. So you open it up, pull out the pips. It's a bit like making marmalade. And then you put the entire orange, peel, pith, everything through the food processor. And with olive oil and flour and all the rest of it. And that's the cake. And it is amazing. You've not tasted, I tell you, it's incredible. And you sort of feel healthy because there's an entire orange in this cake. I decided in lockdown that the thing I needed, well, actually, it wasn't the thing I needed to do in lockdown, but lockdown gave me the time to perfect it. Then with lockdown, I said to Mark, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to actually get the sourdough working properly, because the whole world was making sourdough and flour was kind of difficult to get. But I actually had some in stock, so that was cool.
Together with toilet roll.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, with the toilet roll thing, it really wasn't a problem for us at all, because we subscribe to a service called Who Gives a Crap, which sounds terribly rude, but actually it's an amazing service. I've been subscribing to them for years, and every however many weeks you tell them, you log on and you tell them how long a period you want in between deliveries, and they deliver a box of 40 toilet rolls to your door. And the great thing about this, if there's a lockdown, you can just sit there.
I've never heard of this in all my life.
I know, it's amazing. Well, then during lockdown, you can sit there and smugly go, oh, I'm fine for toilet rolls. I don't need any, because you've got a box of 40 stashed, or whatever's left of your box of 40 stashed in your cupboard. But the reason I signed up to them in the first place, I think it's an Australian company. I saw them online and I thought, actually, I really like the principles of this company, because it's all sustainable. It's all made of bamboo. There's no plastic involved at all. Even each roll is wrapped in bamboo paper. So there is absolutely nothing plastic about it. So I thought, well, that's a good result. But the best thing is that 50% of their profits go into building toilets in parts of the world where there are no toilets. They started this company because they realized, I don't know, somebody had a realization about how many people in the world actually don't have access to good sanitation, and what sort of, you know, what the implications of that are from a disease point of view and community health point of view. And so they decided that it would be appropriate to start a company making and selling toilet paper and putting 50% of their profits into. So I thought, actually, I think that's pretty cool.
I absolutely adore this. I really, I think this is utterly brilliant, but I am still taken by the fact that we are now having a conversation about toilet paper and a company called...
Who gives a crap? I know, it's massively entertaining because their packaging has got all sorts of little tips on what to do while you're doing your thing.
Vandy Massey, here we are in your studio drinking a cup of tea and talking about the use of toilet paper. I don't even know where to take this conversation.
Yeah, it sort of was a little sidebar that sort of, I don't know what. Oh, because we started talking about baking and bread and we ended up on toilet paper. Actually, the problem I had with all this massive, you know, run on toilet paper in the supermarkets was that actually, I mean, it was great for them because they just had, they couldn't manufacture and deliver fast enough. Mm. Yeah. They actually shut off their subscriptions at some point and they emailed everybody who was already a subscriber and said, please don't bring your subscriptions forward. Don't worry about the lack of supply and try and bring your order earlier because we have allocated enough to make sure that we can supply our regular customers. So you will get your supply on time. So don't worry about it. So actually it was really quite nice that for once, something that we had done out of a sense of sort of social conscience had not only paid off in terms of us feeling that we had done, you know, that it was a nice way of actually giving to a charitable cause, but actually a massive personal benefit for what, you know, in a very, very unexpected way. So it was cool. It was fantastic. I'm part of a small group that meets on video every Sunday afternoon. We can drop into we set up a virtual studio, which is a video chat, you know, video room like Zoom. And we drop in. Everybody knows that from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock, you know, is the time when people are going to drop in and say hello and talk about what they've been doing. And most of us set it up in our studios or in our creative space so that we can actually just leave it on in the background and paint and just drop in and out of the conversation. Wow. Okay. That was really helpful because it was connecting with other people.
So you don't have to contribute to the conversation?
No. You can just kind of say, hello, hi, what have I been doing this week? Have a little chat and then just turn off mute your microphone, go about your way. And periodically you'll glance at the screen and see who's there. And so I would leave the audio on so that I could listen to the conversation while I was painting or organizing paints or tidying up or whichever stage I was at in my reconnecting with my art. So I could listen to it. And then as the conversation flowed, if people were chatting, I could drop in when I wanted to, just unmute my mic and have a bit of the conversation, then go back. And it was very comforting and helpful because first of all it was a way of connecting, which is why we set it up, and secondly it was useful just to be able to bounce ideas off other people who might be experiencing the same thing. You know, that was very helpful. So that was one of the things that helped, is realizing that I wasn't the only one, that was happening to other people. And that was interesting because I started to think about why.
Well, that was going to be my question to you. I wonder why.
Well, I don't have an exact answer. I have some theories. So
sock it to me. What's the theory?
Okay, so one of the theories, which was actually something that came up when I was discussing this with a friend, was that artists, I was saying to him, I think the thing that is really, really so interesting is that artists, when you start a painting, there is no degree of certainty about what's going to come out at the other end. It's a journey. And the kind of painting that I do is almost like a dialogue with what's happening on the paper. So you start with an idea, possibly even with a whole image in your head. But as you start to put things on the paper, I find that in my way of painting, I respond to what's happening and I embrace the uncertainty of what's going to come out at the end. For me, that's part of the most exciting, that's the most exciting part of doing it. There is this degree of uncertainty that you embrace at the beginning, and you know that there's a good possibility that this painting may not make it to the end of its journey and you might have to start again, or it might turn into something completely unexpected and delightful, but it could go in any direction. So that was the surprise for me. I sat there and I was thinking, so artists embrace uncertainty in the work that they do. Why are we all struggling so much with the uncertainty of what's happening outside of our studios?
Isn't the possibility got something to do with the fact that there is so much uncertainty, that there's so much change all around us?
When the uncertainty becomes everything is uncertain, it becomes overwhelming. Whereas people who are not used to embracing uncertainty on a daily basis in the things that they do may be able to much more comfortably just block it, put it in a box and go, okay, there's uncertainty here, and I'm just not going to think about that, or I'm going to just go about my normal life and control what I can control.
Because they're more inclined to operate in that fashion. I see that as a correlation to life. That journey is in a controlled environment. In other words, that we know that certain things are going to happen, but I have this freedom within that framework. Whereas then all of that was turned up on its head. And so there isn't any framework in which the freedom exists.
Yeah. And I think one of the problems is it's not just uncertainty. It's uncertainty with quite a scary possibility embedded in. So this isn't a case of, are we going to wake up tomorrow morning and go on a trip to the seaside, or are we going to go on a trip to the mountains? We don't know. That's all uncertain. Nobody's decided yet.
No, this we could wake up tomorrow morning or not wake up.
Correct. And that's the thing. The uncertainty has an additional layer of this fear factor.
Because the world is a very unsafe place at the moment because of this invisible enemy.
And that adds real stress and tension to the whole uncertainty element.
Because it is like a pressure cooker. That's how I felt anyway, and I'm sure how loads of others. And I realized my three things for releasing that pressure. And one of them was to get on with stuff. The other was talking to people, because I found myself not doing that over the last 6 months. I draw my energy from others. People. And the third one, space for myself.
Oh, yeah. Space is big.
Finding space for myself, finding space and just being. And those three things are so obvious. And I know those three things.
Yeah. I heard a really interesting talk by somebody a couple of months ago. He had this ritual every morning, and it struck me that it was a fascinating thing, and I thought I must do that, but I don't slow down enough to do that, and slowing down is something that I really need to learn to do. But he sits
I keep telling my 8-year-old William about let's take moments to slow down, let's pause, let's rest.
But you see, I'm a doer like you. I kind of doing
a doer.
And sometimes I have to just be, but it's finding the time to just be. But this guy has an amazing process, and I thought I really should try this, because it's sort of, it feels to me like quite an interesting cognitive approach to something that is akin to meditation. He carves out, I think he said 25 minutes every morning.
Wow, quite a bit.
Which is that for me. It was like, oh, 25 minutes, that's way too long. I can get so much done in 25 minutes. Maybe I should try 5.
I'm so with you on that.
Yeah, exactly. So he basically sits down every morning with a pad and a piece of paper, and he has a dialogue with his brain. And I thought, what an interesting idea. So he sits down every morning in complete silence by himself. He carves out the space and he goes, okay, brain, what do you want to tell me today? It takes a while. It takes some practice. And of course, this is my problem, is I've been too busy doing. I just thought, what a brilliant idea, because he basically has this conversation with what's in his head. And he says, once you start to do this and you get into the habit, things come out. And then you have this dialogue and your brain will go, I can't, I should be doing all this extra painting and I'm not.
So he's not writing anything down. He's just having a conversation with his brain.
Well, he just listens for the first half. And then the second half, he goes, okay, brain, what are we going to do about this? And then he has this response period where he says, okay, so you've told me that you should be doing all this painting and you're not doing it. And so you feel frustrated about this. So what are you going to do about it, brain? And then he sits there. I think he's actually given his brain a name, but
love it.
It's a way of, I thought, when I thought about it, I thought what he's doing really is he has trained himself to make space to really tap into his subconscious. Because that's what, you know, when he calls it, you know, brain, hello brain, good morning, how are you kind of thing. And he's effectively having this conversation with his brain. What he's doing is he's tapping into his subconscious. He is having a conscious, he's allowing that his subconscious to come into the conscious layer of thought.
But I love the way
the method.
I think the method is brilliant. Because yeah. there's a book called The Inner Game of Tennis. The dude who wrote the Inner Game of Tennis and suggests that we, in order to master the art or the craft of playing tennis, one has to be in self-one mode.
Let
go of the judgments that come as a consequence of good decision-making. Let go of those judgments. Allow yourself to fully be and watch how you can play the shot.
Yeah, so you're sort of stepping out of yourself. There's an interesting parallel there with coming back to the art. Actually, I think this is really interesting because one of the things that happens when you're painting and you're having this sort of the kind of painting where I have a response to what's going on the paper and that leads to the next response and you've got a broad direction, but you are meandering your way through the visual cues that appear and making decisions based on those, is you get into that sense of that state of flow, which is subconscious. And I think that's really interesting. And I think that's when the best creativity happens, because you're not really, you are thinking about it, but it comes naturally, it comes easily. There are moments when you do a painting and you think, actually, you know, that's happened with so little friction, so easily, that it almost feels like it's not a legitimate painting when it comes to sort of putting it in a frame and selling it, because you kind of go, actually, that was too easy. But in many cases, those are the best ones, because they've just emerged from your subconscious and onto the paper without any struggle. Others, you end up struggling for days sometimes. But the point is that what we're talking about with this idea of tapping into your subconscious, I think that's what I was struggling with when I had that block.
When you couldn't paint.
Yeah, because if you come back to it, all of that uncertainty and the tension and the stress that I was dealing with and the busyness of doing other things meant that I was not able to tap into that subconscious flow, when actually all of the uncertainty doesn't matter because you're just focused on the thing that's in front of you.
You've just nailed it for me too.
Yeah.
Totally. It's exactly how I was. And now when I think about it, I'm going back to the tennis analogy. Mm. Your point about the struggle is when there isn't that, when isn't all that stuff, isn't there? When self-one takes over, there isn't a conscious decision-making process that says I've got to do these certain steps, like lean forward, watch the ball, take the racket back, finish on the shoulder, all the rest of the steps and things that you need to do. But the ease with which the execution happens is effortless, total flow. And what happens is pure joy, really, for me, because the other dude or dudess can't get the ball back. And to your point, the opposite, but when I've been so fixated on all the steps that need to happen in order for me to make the shot, in other words, the struggle, in other words, the lockdown pressure and the lockdown anxiety and my own stress from it, when I'm so fixated on all of that stuff, the shot doesn't happen.
No.
Or the shot might happen, or I've hit the ball out, or I've hit it into the net.
Yeah, the difference is about just enjoying the process rather than worrying about the outcome. Because I found in the past, some of my most successful paintings have actually come out of a process, and not just one or two, a fair number of them, particularly when I was in the early days of learning to paint. I would end up working on a painting and struggle and struggle and struggle until eventually I got to the point where I just thought, okay, this is useless. This is not going where I wanted to be, because I was trying to push it in a particular direction. I was trying to push it in the direction that my intellectual brain was telling me it needed to go in, rather than tapping into the subconscious of what I was trying to do. And when I got to that point, what would happen is I would go, there'd be like a switch. I would go, right, this is ruined. It's going in the bin. But before it goes in the bin, I'm going to use it to play. And the minute I tapped into that play and I started just going, okay, I'm going to just see what I can do with this. And I would literally sometimes take a brush full of paint and throw it, fling it across the easel just to go, right, I'm going to wake this thing up, not in anger or frustration, but in just like, I'm going to give this thing a bit of energy and let's see what happens. And you just literally flick that paint at the board, at the paper, and, you know, let it land where it lands, and then step back and go, right, now it isn't what I started out doing. Now the struggle is basically in the background. It's gone because I've just whacked a whole lot of bright blue paint across the front of it. Now what am I going to do with it? Okay, let's play. And remarkably, even though in some instances the intention of the play was, okay, just what can I learn from this? And then it's going to go in the bin, or I'm going to tear it up and use the back of it for practice sheets or whatever, I would end up half an hour later and step back and go, actually, I really like this. Wow, something magical has happened on the paper. Something magical has happened in front of me. Yeah.
And that let's play for me is all the things that we know is being present, letting go of the struggle, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I liken it to improv. My background, yes, as an artist was improvised theatre. And you'd walk into a rehearsal room. You've got the part. What part? There isn't a part. You haven't created it yet. You've got a place in this ensemble. And now we're going to create something here. And there is a requirement then to be fully present and play. Play. That's all we do. And eventually from that play comes something that is recognizable.
There was a real turning point for me at the end of actually this summer, which is quite interesting, because I started out, in terms of going back to where we started, in terms of this whole I should be painting, the narrative in my head about beating myself up because I wasn't creating a masterpiece every 3 days, because, you know, now I was home and I could access my studio more regularly. I started doing little bits of that play. So I would come into the studio. So my solution was come into the studio, make sure I'm here, turn up every day, because I think that is kind of important. Turn up without judgment. Try and suspend the judgment, switch it off, but actually turn up to the studio. Because if you're not in the studio, you are definitely not going to produce anything at all. And this is my creative space. And then do something. If it's tidying up a shelf, that's fine. Just quietly put a podcast on or put some music on and enjoy tidying up the space and get absorbed in working out what you're trying to do. Sit down and look at a book. You know, read a book or look at some reference material of something that you want to do, but be in the studio as often as I could. And so when she arrived, I had this piece of board propped up against the wall on a bench in the garden with 1.5 meters wide and a meter deep, more or less, paper pinned to this board, and all the paints laid out. And I said, why don't we paint a collaborative painting? Paint this thing together. Actually, physically, you put brushstrokes on it and I'll put brushstrokes on it and we'll combine and let's just let rip and see what happens. And she was game for it. So we just said, okay, so where do we start? What's the theme? And we were standing in this garden and I said, this garden has been my sanity through lockdown, because it's been wild and it's been uncontrolled and I've been working in the garden and growing our vegetables in between the flowers. And it's been my sort of physical outlet and also my mental health, I think, because just being able to be outside amongst flowers has been great. And it's the space where we have painted together before. It's the space where we first managed to work together on our creativity. Why don't we just let the garden be our inspiration? And she said, fantastic. And at the end of it, the interesting thing was that we stepped back and both of us just thought, I really love this painting. It was so interesting that the breakthrough moment was actually not about battling through or being judgmental. It was absolutely the opposite. There was no judgment. There was a connection with somebody else who has the same joy of painting as I do in her own way. There was an acceptance. Space. Yeah. An acceptance that both of us have space, quite, yeah, a whole day of just going, we're just going to have fun with this and it doesn't matter what happens at the end. What we do know is that we're going to have fun with it and that's the only thing that really counts, that matters. And that was transformational for both of us. I think we both stood there and our one observation was that we just felt like a weight had been lifted. It was a liberating day. And the outcome was amazing.
The question I have in my head is, how do I do that for myself in life? It's that, yes, it's being present. Yes, it's creating space. Yes, it's that acceptance thing that without judgment, that's about being present. That is the essence of being present. And that collaboration thing, that coming together, we as human beings want to connect with each other.
I think we can do it in small ways too. You know, I mean, this was a big thing for us this whole day. We consciously carved out. I mean, it was the third time we'd painted together. So it was sort of, we'd built up to this. But maybe that's the point, is that when you do that, you have breakthroughs, not only in terms of your mental health, but it frees you up to try doing things differently as well, other things. I think there's a ripple effect in your life. When you do these things, I think other things start to become better and easier as well.
I would agree. I think when we're less fixated on that which we're doing or fixated on an outcome, we open ourselves up to a sense of freedom, which gives us a feeling of being less contained, and we create.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a bit like sort of chaos theory, but in a very positive way. You know, one thing leads onto another and you don't know exactly, you know, you put something in place now. You know, I think as human beings, we have this very bad habit of sort of saying, well, that didn't work, so I'm going to give up and not do anything more. And we stop doing things. And this is why I felt that it was really important to turn up in the studio every day, even if I knew that I was probably only going to tidy up the bookshelf or reorganize some art materials. Yeah. It was just keep going, just keep turning up, keep doing things. Don't give up. Just give yourself space and time and acceptance to get to the bit that you're going to get to. Because by turning up, you create the possibility, you create that space for good things to happen. I read an article about child development. The interesting idea of how we help children to become resilient. Certainly when I was growing up, we had this end of the year or end of the term in South Africa. You had a report card that gave you all your percentages and basically had scores for every subject and all the rest of it. And you know, the old fashioned sitting for exams at the end of the year and sitting for tests in between. I remember, you know, the process of walking home from school the day on the report card day with either a feeling of, sure, okay, it's going to be all right. Parents are going to be happy and that's cool. Or, you know, they're not going to be that happy about. Have you ever found your old report cards? I'm by the way, mine. Some of them are really interesting.
I've still got mine. I still read one of the comments. Mine was, Dion would do very well if he was less talkative in class.
Well, it is interesting how those things from our childhood actually reveal some really interesting stuff. Because I found my sons a couple of days, I was tidying something up, and I found one of my sons, and that was hilarious, because when I look at him now, I think, oh, my heavens, five. He was already doing that at the age of five. You know, he wants to make a difference, and that's fair enough. But mine, the one that made me laugh on mine was the fact that I think one year I got an F for religious instruction or religious education. And the comment was that I might have got a better result if I'd actually been prepared to hand in the book, as I'd been told to do. So I obviously just refused to do the book because I didn't think it was actually anything that was interesting or worthwhile doing. So I wasn't going to do it. So, yeah. My point, going back to where I started, was we are hardwired to reward outcomes, results. And so we praise children for results. Oh, fantastic, you got an
A. And business is all about results.
Results, it is.
Life, results. But,
absolutely. And so that's what we are driven to aim for, is the result. Where I think we have a problem is that the message is so strongly about results that what we forget is that in the pursuit of getting to those results, in the process of getting to those results, failures have to happen along the way. Because if you don't have the failures, every failure is one step closer to a success. Mm-hmm. And if we only reward children and ourselves for results, and we beat ourselves up or reprimand or don't give approval to children who don't get the best results, all we do is we train ourselves to avoid trying. Because what we're doing is we're saying the consequences of not succeeding are uncomfortable.
And I don't like uncomfortable, so
I'm going to step away and just go, okay, no, maybe I won't. Maybe I'll just go and do something else. Maybe I'll just stop trying to create art, and I'll go. And I think that's okay as a conscious temporary move. So where I was saying, well, I went and did some stuff in the garden and I went into the kitchen and I focused on other things. I still kept turning up as well, because what I didn't want to do was say, well, I'm no good at that, and therefore it's too uncomfortable, so I'm not going to do it. What I think this article that I read about how we help children build resilience was saying that there'd been some tests, and that children who were praised for effort actually in the long run did better than children who were praised for result, because the children who were praised for effort carried on trying. Mm. So for them, understanding that it was turning up every day and having another go and was how they were eventually going to get there. So the children who are high achievers naturally, because they are bright or they get the subject. So for those, it's almost as if those people who have that natural ability, sometimes because they've had early success and have been praised for that, will struggle in areas where they don't have such a high natural ability, because they've never been taught that effort is worth being praised for.
That's why I still remember my mother was brilliant at that. She used to have a conversation with me and said, and that conversation was around whether or not I did my best. I would express my feelings and she would praise me for the work I'd put into it and emphasize that more so than the results themselves.
Yeah. And I think one of the keys is to see it as an opportunity rather than to try and see the opportunities rather than the barriers. Because I think what's been really interesting for me is I was at a stage with my art, certainly, it's about embracing it and getting used to doing it and then finding methods to do it better. And that's an opportunity that I think.
And you could be creative.
Yes.
Well, this has been fantastic opportunity. I've loved it. I really love talking to you. We've chewed the fat quite considerably over the last
while. Had a good ramble, haven't we?
Yeah.
Starting from toilet paper and going all the way around.
I actually forgot about the toilet paper. Well, that's a wrap. So thank you very much. I really, really appreciate it. It's been really good fun, and it's been a laugh, and it's been also interesting. And it's been reassuring on my part too. I felt really, really reassured by hearing your story and the stories of others.
Well, thank you. And this has been my first podcast. So this is an opportunity that I have embraced. Thank you to your encouragement. I'm very grateful for the opportunity and I've loved it. I've really enjoyed it. It's been a great chat and fantastic having a conversation and really interesting to see the parallels between the things that you've experienced and the things that I've experienced, because I think those are always useful and I think we can learn so much from the way other people have approached things.
I'm with you 100%, we do. So that's it. The name's Neubronner, Dion Neubronner. You're listening to my podcast, Life, Purpose, Leadership.